What is over 19,000 feet high and 4 million years old? Well, it's not today's guest. Let's find out what it is. We want to welcome back our friend, Dr. Robert Scanlon, who was just on a very interesting hike, what we might call a bucket list hike that many of us talk about doing. Dr. Scanlon, welcome back to Papa Bear Hikes.
Thank you so much for having me on, Martin.
So tell us what's over 4 million years old and 19,000 feet in elevation.
Yeah, definitely not me just yet. I'm getting there. But Mount Kilimanjaro has beat me to that statistic.
Were you feeling 4 million years old when you got up there?
Yeah. It definitely humbles you. At least me, you know, I'm just a mere human, mere mortal.
So Rob, let me ask you this. As I said in the intro, it's a bucket list type of hike. You talk to a lot of hikers, whether they are people who do peaks or just like to hike trails. Kilimanjaro comes up on a lot of people's list. Yeah. What motivated you to want to do this hike?
So, you know, it's one of the, is it seven great peaks or, but doable without, you know, technical, equipment, you know, it's doable, as a hike. You know, as we were talking before, you know, this was, you know, I think I'd seen pictures of people on at the summit and be like, wow, 19,000 feet. Jesus, that's a long way up. And I'm like, yeah, one day I'd love to do that. And the opportunity for it came up much sooner than I had anticipated. I figured it was, you know, 5 years or so down the road after I've done everything that I really wanted to do here in the US and Canada. And the opportunity just came up and I took it.
Right, because when we think of climbing mountains, you talked about technical gear. Obviously, the big one that always comes up is Everest, right? And, you know, just kind of a running joke, I think, now at this point that, you know, if you have the money, you can summit Everest. It's not right. Easy, but, you know, if you have the money to pay for the gear and the guides, it's doable. Mount Rainier, which has a lot more failed attempts than Everest every year, does require a lot of technical gear and equipment to summit that and preparation. But this was a summit. Sounds like you pretty much just needed backpacking gear.
Right. Absolutely. There's one little part of it that you're using all four limbs to get past a narrow segment on a vertical wall. But that's a, you know, fairly short in the grand scheme of the whole event. But yes, it's a hikeable, hike up to the summit type of, you know, bucket list summit, which was very attractive, you know, not, you know, we're both East Coasters. I'm a, you know, a sea level dweller for most of my life. My heart is out West, but my job is here. So, so this is where I live. And so technical climbing experience doesn't come along at sea level. Yeah, you can do a wall at a gym or something like that, but it's not the same. And so you don't want to, you know, have your first experience in a, you know, death-defying technical climb. You'd want to be very, very facile at that before, and especially going to a foreign country to do that, because the medical care, God forbid, you know, you fall and you need care, you know, the medical care may not be what we're used to, the cost of getting flown out and surgery or whatever you need, that's huge.
Right. So physical preparedness is probably at the top of the list, I would imagine. But, you know, you talked about, you know, non-technical, but bouldering, what, you know, many of us might call scrambling or bouldering, which we get mm-hmm. a little bit of in different areas. Up in the Adirondacks, we get a little bit of it. Some places in the Catskills or Vermont, definitely in New Hampshire. So, yeah, doing that with a backpack on, a full backpack, I know you just got Mount Mansfield. Right? When you're doing some of these areas with a full pack, it could be a little intimidating, knowing that if I just lean the wrong way, this pack's just going to pull me back and I'm not right. doing anything to stop. I'm just going.
Right. Yeah, your entire center of gravity is completely thrown off. It's much higher and much further back on your body with that, you know, and the heavier the and the bigger the backpack, the worse that is. And yeah, you just lift up your head and you're forget it. You're already leaning back and what have you.
Right. You're not just going to fall on your tail.
So not being a technical climber, that was, you know, a realistic bucket list hike for me until I eventually get that kind of, you know, technical experience down.
Mm-hmm. Rob, what kind of training did you do? Let's first break it down like this. What type of physical training did you do to prepare for the hike?
Yeah. So that was tough. You know, again, when you don't have steep hills and peaks to practice on, or altitude to, you know, try to acclimate to, and how do you do that? It's sea level. And so I went from being a non-runner to a runner. And so I just wanted to increase my VO2 max. And I hated running. And, you know, I really realized it's, I hated it because it's hard. And, you know, there's a quote by Marcus Aurelius. I hope I don't screw it up. Comfort is the worst addiction. We don't grow as individuals, as people, as, you know, we don't get to evolve out of routine and comfort. So I learned, you know, in the last handful of years when I became friendly with a bunch of special operations military guys, you know, we grow out of discomfort. Discomfort is the best thing we can do for ourselves, and pick the things that you hate to do and do it because you hate it, because you will develop an increasing tolerance to difficult things in life. And there was no better example for me with running. And so I started running, and, you know, half a mile, and you're like, oh my God, I want to stop. And I would literally yell at myself. Like, people, you know, watching or listening, you know, or in their houses or whatever, watching me running down the road, yelling at myself, calling me a, you know, I won't say it. But, you know, I say, well, you want to stop? All right, fine. You know, I just added a mile onto the run now. You know, you're going to want to complain. You know, I was trying to like be this like two person, you know, and basically defeating that part of my brain that wanted to stop and seek comfort. And so I had to beat that one down, because I knew that, you know, going uphill for 7 days straight to, you know, ungodly altitudes, I was going to be uncomfortable. I was going to be short of breath. So I decided I need to train so that I'm used to being short of breath for extended periods of time. And so there's no better way to do it than through running. I also do like circuit training, you know, a circuit between pull-ups, push-ups, shoulder presses, you know, bicep curls, crunches, this, that, and the other, all in a continuous circuit for about 5 minutes. I feel like I want to die. And then I rest for 3 minutes and then I repeat. I try to do 3-4 or so rounds of that. And just to, again, do the uncomfortable things just to get ready for, you know, the discomfort of that hike. In retrospect, I probably should have done more bicycling under resistance. Because bicycling is a really good, you know, mashing the quads down, you know, with under resistance or underweight. And that I think when not able to hike uphill regularly to train, that probably would have been a little bit better for my quads to ready them for 7 days of constant uphill. So
that's interesting you say that, Rob. In 2020, during the pandemic, I bought a bicycle and started biking again. And I was going out 3, sometimes 5 times a week riding my bike. And I made sure at least twice I was going up this really steep hill behind us. And I started out first couple of times I had to actually start walking the bike up. I just was gassed and said, all right, I'll walk it up. But, you know, shortly I was able to ride it all the way up. But when I went out on my hike that summer, I went up to the Adirondacks and I just felt so much more physically fit.
Yeah.
Right. Felt my legs were stronger. I didn't feel as winded.
Yeah, it's really interesting how it really, you know, if you like uphill or you know, if you're on a stationary bike, just ramp up that resistance and just get through the crying moments and just keep pushing. And right. Boy, it really, really does so much. So I've rolled that into my routine now in preparation for whatever comes up next.
We'll be back after a quick break.
You ever think about what might be in the water you're drinking every time you fill up your water bottles while you're in the outdoors? I try not to, and I really don't, because I use Sawyer water filters. Sawyer filter technology, because of their high standards, every filter is individually tested 3 times through the process. I've been using their permethrin product for years now to protect me from, well, quite frankly, ticks, and the picaridin to keep the flies at bay. Don't let bad water, insects, or a tick bite cut your trip short or even ruin it. Use Sawyer products. Go to your local outdoor retailer and ask for Sawyer products, whether it's a water filter, insect repellent, they're likely to have it. You can also go to Sawyer's website and read more about these incredible, high-quality products that they offer those of us who enjoy the outdoors.
Yeah, this will be part of your routine now from here on out for whatever hike you do. That's great.
Right. And I started to mix in some Bulgarian squats too, the one-legged squats. You know, start out without weights, and then you put some dumbbells in your hands and do the Bulgarian squats. And that really isolates the quads one at a time, and really just again mashing down under weight is something I've also subsequently rolled into the routine.
My experience has been that I've tried to introduce more things. And this past year, I started trail running, found a nice trail, and boy, was that humbling! I can hike 10 plus miles a day running. Yeah, you know, okay, I'll go out and do it. So I was doing interval training, right? Where, you know, started out with 60 seconds run, you know, stop, et cetera, right?
Right.
Boy, was that humbling. I was like, oh, I'm out of shape.
Isn't that the most frustrating thing? You're busting your chops going uphill on a hike, and some trail runner just like leaves you in their dust. They come from behind you and just like whoop, right past you. And you're like, oh my God, not even worthy of this mountain.
I know. I was with my oldest one time in Vermont, and we had that happen. And we just like looked at each other and say, boy, do we feel so inferior. That guy just didn't. He lifted up his hand to wave hello and just kept on going. And we'll probably be sitting and having a beer before we're able to eat lunch today.
Yeah, you definitely feel like an immortal there.
Yeah. So now there's the mental side of it. Right, because you knew that there was going to be more technical climbing than we're used to seeing out here in the East. You know, you were handling the physical preparation. What were you doing to mentally prepare for this?
That was basically rolled into the training, and just you know, getting comfortable with being uncomfortable, and trying to sustain that for as long as possible, and quiet that part of my mind that again wanted to stop. And just rest. And, you know, most of us give in to that unless we learn how to just put it away or defeat it in some way. I didn't do anything specific otherwise, really. It was a part of the training buildup, which I took about 6 months to do. And so I went from, you know, being a non-runner to, my longest run was 10 miles. I mean, it's not a tremendous thing. There's plenty of long distance runners who are listening to this podcast or laughing at that. I attempted a half marathon distance. It was in mid-December. I was doing great. Oh my God. I felt wonderful. It was raining out, but I just ran through it. I was soaking wet, but I felt so wonderful. And then all of a sudden I blew a hamstring. And then I could barely walk back to my house. So I didn't get to do the half marathon distance. So, but I'm planning on going at that and beyond from here, but I was, so I'll get to the actual hike, but yeah, so, but at least, you know, I was able to sustain that much and not stop and mentally get through that. And finally get to the point where I was actually enjoying the run. And, you know, the runners always talk about like, oh, I never got euphoric. I've never gotten euphoric yet. And maybe that'll come, but I at least enjoyed the running part of it and what it did for me. And I enjoyed the progress too.
It's motivating. When I did my first, I had a goal. I wanted to be able to do 5K without stopping straight through and try to do it in under 30 minutes. I was working myself up to that, and wow, that was a great feeling and very motivating. Yeah,
absolutely. And road running, way different than treadmill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was treadmill running the last couple of weeks. I was away, and it's all I had, and it was freezing cold outside. So I decided and then I just did a road run last night, 5 miles. I was like, oh my God, this is so much worse than the treadmill.
Yeah. Yep. No, I mean, it's the difference between a road walk and a trail walk. What about backpacking, right? I know when I always dread on a long day that I have to do any road walking because my feet are going to get beat up. It's going to be so much worse on my feet hitting that pavement. So how many miles is it from the trailhead to the summit, Rob?
That is a great question. I actually never looked that up. It's 40 miles. Yeah. 40. Yeah, exactly. I didn't want it to psych me out or give me some type of mental, like, yeah, I could do that. You know, I wanted to enter it neutral. So many people who had watched every video online, everything on YouTube on Mount Kilimanjaro, they're watching and they're, you know, just consuming all of it. And I watched one video that was offered by the guide service, and that was it. I wanted to come in as neutral as possible, unassuming, and just and come in a little intimidated by it so that it would motivate me to keep going. But the overall miles, I actually don't know. And it would be surprisingly shorter than most people would imagine. But 40 miles seems to come to mind. And I don't know if that's a one way or if that's a round trip. But you'd think it would be longer than that.
Yeah. And when you started explaining, I thought, okay, that probably makes sense because there's 40 miles. 40 miles could be so much different depending on where you're at, right? If you're in the South, 40 miles is nothing. Like hiking through Connecticut, right? That's only 52 miles or something on the AT. That's an easy 52 miles.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Totally.
Or hiking 40 miles in New Hampshire on the AT. Big difference.
And they have different routes. There's a 5-day route, I think 6, 7, and 8-day routes. I think they barely do the 5-day route anymore because it is just too fast for most people to acclimate to the change in altitude. So I did the 7-day Limosho route. And so each day we were hiking maybe 5-6 hours. You know, it wasn't a lot, you know, not like we were, you know, from sun up to sundown. We were, you know, 5-6 hours, and, you know, we'd accumulate a couple thousand feet in elevation. You know, we'd stop or we'd come to a certain elevation and then tease our bodies with an hour or two at 1,000 feet high, and then come back down and camp at that lower elevation, and then just constantly tease the body as we were getting, you know, higher and higher. So at sea level, we're both breathing 21% oxygen. And so how the physics works out, it's still technically 21% FiO2 or, you know, fraction of inhaled oxygen, but the effective amount of oxygen at the summit is somewhere between 9% and 10%. So it's about half or a little less than half of what we're we're breathing now. So obviously it's dropping all, you know, the whole way up. And so getting used to doing all that exercise with the altitude, with the low oxygen, they didn't really want anybody to go too far, too fast.
Yeah, it sounds like, right, just there's two things. You want to have an enjoyable experience, and more importantly, you want it to be safe. You want everybody to be safe.
Right, right.
It's not a race, right? As I tell people, it's not about, yeah, it's not a race. It's...
Yeah, as, speaking of races, there were some extreme, you know, ultra marathon runner from Europe. I want to think Switzerland. He holds the world record for summiting Kilimanjaro. And I don't know if it was a round trip or to the summit, but it was something in the order of 5.5 to 6 hours.
I think I read about that. Yeah.
That's just inconceivable to me, but you know, maybe he was dwelling at you know, 18,000-19,000 feet in the Alps somewhere, and then, you know, he takes a trip to Africa and then just, you know, just whizzes it out. But dang, that's a,
yeah,
that was,
yeah, the first thing I thought is, yeah, wow, you have to adapt very quickly with that, at that pace, right? How quickly your body has to adjust.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I read that story. Yeah, that was the first thing I thought about it. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We were talking about it when we were out, you know, out there. You know, somebody brought it up from the you know, in our group. And everyone's like, what? Just inconceivable. But that is, you know, that he is, whoever that is superhuman.
Rob, you talked about, you know, certain number of hours hiking every day. What was the hiking like? Like, you had a backpack. Did you carry all your food for the entire hike, or did you get to a base camp and things were set up for you?
Yeah. So it's Tanzanian law that you have to go with a guide service. The guide service has guides, of course, and porters. So the porters, you know, take, you know, the tents, the food, the, you know, the things that are prepared, you know, that they prepare the food with, all that stuff. And the hiker is just with their day pack. And so you just put in whatever you want in your day pack. Is that, that's snacks and extra beers and what have you. Day packs maybe 20, 25 pounds at most. And there's also porters who take your other stuff. You know, so you have a duffel with all of your, you know, your clothing, your layers, your, you know, sleep gear, that kind of stuff. And so, so that was, that's max 33 pounds or 15 kilos. And so the porters are able to carry up to the 15 kilos. So, you had a porter that would bring up your duffel and all that stuff. So as easy as compared to, you know, through hikes where you are your own porter, in that regard. So it was really just the hiking for us. And by the time we got to camp, yeah, largely the tents were set up for the most part. And we would go into the mess tent and get, you know, food or fluids or whatever we wanted. You know, it's not like, you know, white glove service, wasn't right. So much glamping, but all that was taken care of, you know, for and you can't show up to Killy and say, nah, I got this. I'm going. They won't let you in the park if you're not with a guide service.
Right. Cause I had read that, right. That it's similar to Everest in this sense that, right. There's orders that help bring and right, it's not your choice. It's what they want. It's what, you know, it's the law, like you said, yeah. And they bring your stuff and you hike to a base camp.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what was life like in the base camps?
Yeah, so the you know, January is supposed to be a short dry season in between rainy seasons, and it was not dry. It rained on us every day, so we slogged through mud and really slippery rocky trails. And I would say there's a total of about maybe 100 feet of groomed trail on the entire route that I took. And it's just completely rugged, walking and, you know, what have you. Each camp was a little different in topography and weather and such, but it rained pretty much every day, except for the last day, thank God. And some were more drenching than others. So depended on, you know, when you got to the camp, whether it was a pleasant experience or you were, you know, completely unpleasant based on, you know, how bad the rain was, and how much mud you had all over you. But otherwise, you know, it was a comfort knowing that, you know, things were largely otherwise set up for you. You know, someone was going to be cooking, and, you know, you could, all you need to do was sit down and just, you know, rest your pegs and just consume all the carbs you need to. It was a very carb heavy situation. And so carbs are king, as people who watch my Instagram videos on nutrition know that carb is king. Carbs are king out there. And so there's lots of carbs, which is fine. We were all
Carbs are always real tasty.
yeah. You know, lots of African hot chocolate and tea or coffee, whatever you wanted, and that kind of stuff. So they were all very, very gracious. So it was nice, and it was pleasant coming into camp to have that already set up, because it would suck if you're soaked from outside to in and to have to put your own tent up and everything else, which, again, plenty of people listening right now or through hikers are like, you're a weakling, we've all done that, but to do that, you know, soaking wet is just unpleasant, you know.
No way. I've done it soaking wet. And you know what? If somebody wants to carry my gear ahead and set it up for me, I'll sign up for it. I'm not afraid to say, hey, yeah, anybody who's ever set up a tent in the rain after hiking in the rain all day, yeah, I say you're full of crap if you're telling me you wouldn't sign up for somebody to set up for you.
And, you know, there was a head, it was like head porter for the tents, and then he had a couple underlings. And so the head guy, he was just so hardworking. I think it was the third or fourth day. And so I got to know him. His name was Raymond. And I said, Raymond, you work so hard. And I handed him cash. I said, I don't want anything more from you. I just want you to be appreciated. I want you to know you were appreciated for all your hard work. But inevitably after that, oh my God, he took care of me. He had deep trenches, you know, for the rain runoff, all, you know, surrounding the tent and everything else. Poor guy. He was so grateful for I guess, you know, my contribution to him. But that turned out to be a very good asset. And I always got the best spot after that. It was like, what? How'd you get you that spot in your tent? I'm like, I don't know.
It reminds me, I watched a documentary quite a few years ago with the actor Ewan McGregor, who him and another actor who I don't know his name, he's popular in England, and they did a motorcycle ride from one end of Africa to the other. And he talked about how they were the nicest, most generous people. He'd go into villages where the people, you know, in relation to what we have in the West, were the most generous people he'd ever come across.
Yes. Very, very.
And very nice. It sounds like the people you were dealing with who work there were just so nice.
Right. To a person. They're absolutely gracious and, you know, accommodating, very friendly. We all, you know, we were just talking about, you know, each other's lives and, you know, things like that. Just talking about real stuff, real life stuff. And you connect with them, you know, on a personal level, because, you know, all the themes are the same. You know, you love your family, you care about your kids, and, you know, want them to grow up happy, and, you know, it's all the same stuff. It's just different location, and obviously we have much more means and way more than what we need here. But we could speak on the same language in that regard, you know, because life is just life.
It's something I've said many times on this podcast, and I say it in my book, that the trail is a great equalizer. We're really all the same.
Yeah.
you were just another hiker. You weren't Dr. Scanlon. You were another hiker. And he, you know, and to him, he was, you guys were on the same ground. You were on the same playing field and had the same, like you said, you still have, you have families you love. You have, concerns in life. And that's, right, to me, one of the great things about going into the outdoors.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can, titles and stature in society and everything else just don't matter. And it's great for me. I'm not one of those doctors like, no, call me doctor. I earned that title, like that kind of thing. Hmm. I'm Rob, Right. That's what my parents called me. Doctor is just something I do, 9 to 5, Monday to Friday and some weekends. And so I'm happy to talk to people as a neutral, anonymous, guy who's got a family,
All right. But I think that's sort of the attitude of a lot of people that go into the outdoors is that they're not, that's who I am. That's how I make my living, but it's not who I am when I'm out here. That's, when I punch out, I'm done for the day. And now I'm just Rob or I'm just Martin. That's it.
You got it. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the food in base camp. Some people, including myself, might find this interesting. Was it food that was unique to that area?
Surprisingly, it was very similar. And I'm sure they probably held back on some of the traditional cuisine. There was one night that they did serve some more traditional type of meal. And if I can remember now, it was some type of green. It was probably like spinach or some type of green like that. It was sauteed and balls of what wound up being like polenta. And so the trick there is to make the ball of polenta and then dip it into the greens and try to get them together and eat it together with your hand, no forks and knives. And that was part of one of the, like that one night that they did like a Tanzanian meal. Otherwise, like breakfast was always porridge, bread. You had cereal available to you. Again, the hot chocolate, coffee, tea. Some days I just drank hot water. It's so funny. I felt so healthy, so amazing during the 6 months that I was training. And then 2 days before I left, I get sick and I'm coughing my head off and I don't know what I got. And I don't even want to test because I don't want to know. And so about day two or so, I lost my sense of smell and taste. So I think I know what I had.
Yeah.
And so I was drinking hot water. It might as well have been, coffee or hot chocolate, because I didn't taste it anyway. But it just felt good to have hot liquid coming down my throat. It was cereals, porridge, this and that. And so once in a while, it would be bacon or a sausage, some eggs. They do throw in a little protein there. And then lunch wound up being soup, more sort of bready kind of stuff. I forget now. But again, more carby stuff. Dinner was soup again, usually vegetable soup, and the vegetable always changed. So the whole time we're like, all right, what's the soup going to be like now? There was not a lot of meat. It was some we'd put a little bit on our plates just to pass around, but it was mostly carbs. But basically, there's not a lot of way to preserve that stuff. So the carbs are easy to store. You toast the bread or you mix the oats with the water, you make porridge, that kind of thing. So the meats are much, much more difficult to preserve for the week. Eggs, they throw some eggs into the dinner as well. But again, very, very carby meals, rice, potatoes, that kind of stuff.
Right. These are meals that are planned for hikers, sounds like.
Yes. Yes.
Right. To meet the nutritional needs of the people who are hiking.
Right. Right. Replace that glycogen, you know, make sure that your muscles have all the glycogen they need for the next day.
When you reach the summit, I always love asking this question. How did you feel and what was going through your head?
Oh, wow. There was a lot of stuff. So the summit, so we got completely drenched on our way to the last base camp before the summit. And so that base camp sat at 15,000 feet. And the plan was nap until 10, and then we'll wake you up at 10 p.m. We'll eat something, and then we start hiking to the summit at 11 p.m. And I'm a very, very horrible sleeper. Even though I'm board certified in sleep medicine, it's not a choice. My brain will not allow sleep to happen if there's anything a little different. I don't know why. It's just my burden that I carry with me. So I did not sleep a wink the whole time up until that point. And I did not nap before the summit. I was exhausted to begin with. And you're at 15,000 feet, the effective oxygen's, you know, somewhere between 21% and 10%. So probably along the lines of like 14 or so. And it's all uphill. It's no switchbacks. You know, it's very East Coast style uphills. And so almost directly straight uphill, you know, unless you had a big rock formation to go around or something like that, but it was pretty much straight uphill. And the breathing for me, at least, it took 7 hours to get there. We summited at 5:45 AM. We started off at 11 PM. And every step of the way, and it was a pretty slow hike, every step of the way was as if I was sprinting. As short a breath as I was for the 7 hours. And I was at an extreme headache, dizzy as hell. And all I could think of, and again, I was going back to, you know, these military guys I've become friendly with, and, you know, they talk about, you know, when everything else looks like it's crumbling, just focus on your 3-foot world, everything around you, 3 foot. That's the only thing that matters. Take care of what is in that little space. And so all I did was with my headlamp down, I could see the hiker's feet in front of me and just match their steps. It's one more step and one more step. And I just kept on doing that. One more step, one more. And that is what got me up to the top. And so you stop at Stella Point, which is not yet the summit, but that's pretty close to the elevation of the summit. And that's when things start flattening out, thank God. And so there was some emotional stuff I had going on with my, you know, losing my mom in 2019. I'm happy to share that, but I don't want to bore your listeners. After sitting and kind of catching breath, et cetera, then we set out for Uruhu Point or Uruhu Peak, which is the actual official summit of Kilimanjaro after that. But it took another hour and a half after reaching the Stella Point. We thought we were there, and they're like, got another hour and a half. And they're like, oh, my God. And so by now my fingers are, you know, I've got double gloves on. I got, you know, double socks on with, you know, good boots and everything else. And my toes and my fingers are like numb and frozen by now. And I still got an hour and a half left to get to Uruhu. So I had to get creative, with trying to preserve my fingers. I just kept on thinking of the actor, you know, there's the movie Everest.
Yes.
Where I can't think of the actor's name now. He plays the physician who comes home with with his nose is basically gone from
Josh Brolin's character.
Yes. Josh Brolin. Exactly. So I'm thinking like, oh my God, I'm pulling a Josh Brolin here. So I had to get creative with trying warm up my hands and getting them unfrozen. But we got to the summit point. It was definitely euphoric because, you know, 6 months in the waiting and I'm finally there. And so everybody got their pictures taken and all that stuff. And, you know, some people are goofing off and I'm like, can we get off this ice cube now, please? It was negative 21 up there. Wow. And windy as hell. And so we were the first. So there was a bunch of, you know, it's usually 14 to a group. It was a bunch of groups, a hell of a lot of groups, like at least 10 to 15 groups that were behind us. We were the first to summit that night or morning. And we got there before sunrise, which you're supposed to time it for sunrise, but that's okay. I just wanted to get to the summit. And so we, on the way down, we got the sunrise, but we were passing all these other people coming up. As I understand, there was another group from our guide service was bringing up, and out of the 14, seven of them had to get flown out for altitude sickness from that 15,000 foot base camp. So we were pretty lucky as a group that, you know, all of us made it. None of us had really bad issues. You know, mine were headaches and not sleeping, but that was okay.
What was the temperature at the base camp? I'm trying to put some perspective on the changes in the temperatures from when you get that high.
It was interesting. So, you know, again, we had cloud cover and rain most of the time. When that was the case, it was cold. And I don't know the temperature numbers offhand. When we got up there, we were soaking wet. We were cold. And I was clearly heading into a moderate degree of hypothermia. So it was windy up there, you know, soaked right through to my skin, through every one of my layers. My rain gear completely failed. It was just got overwhelmed. My boots, like every time I took a step, I could feel the water sloshing between my toes. It was that bad. My boots were soaked. And so I had to take care of myself in that hypothermic state. And within an hour of that, the clouds just spontaneously cleared out, just like a gift from God, honestly. And all of a sudden, it got really hot because we're that much closer to the sun. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I would say it depends on whether it's night or day, cloud cover or sunlight during the day. And it was such a stark difference. Oh my God, it was just crazy difference between not having the sun and getting the sun.
Yeah, that altitude. Yeah, you can have a very radical shift in temperatures. Right, I understand that. Yeah, wow,
absolutely.
Rob, would you recommend this hike to anybody, or would you tell me I need to move it up on my list?
I definitely would, and you know, I a lot of people, I guess, look to people who go abroad and you're like, you know, like it's not an ego thing. And I did it for personal growth, for, you know, to set out a challenge for me to grow from and to learn from. And that exceeded my expectations in that, and exceeded my goal in that. And so, it, from that standpoint, I would highly recommend doing that. Financially, it wasn't horrible. You know, the guide service, the flight, I did not go business class. I went the whatever, something comfort or premium comfort or something like that. It was just a little bit more than coach and a lot less than business class, but the all in, I think it was like $6,000, which isn't terrible. It doesn't break the bank for most people, and certainly not the Everest cost of $60,000 and 3 months of no income while you're there waiting for, you know, the weather to open up to climb up. It's a chance to do a bucket list at a fairly affordable way to go, and an opportunity to really learn what you're made of and what you can put up with. And again, we don't grow unless we put ourselves into these circumstances, and you know, I highly recommend it for all serious hikers and who really want to learn about themselves.
Dr. Robert Scanlon, if we want to follow you on social media, how can we do so?
So I'm mostly on Instagram. I'm at Dr. Rob Scanlon. So it's a DR underscore Rob Scanlon, one word. Or just Google, you know, Goofy Reels, and that'll I'll probably show up somewhere.
Well, Rob, as always, I enjoy getting caught up here with you and hearing about this amazing adventure. I thank you for coming on and sharing it with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me on again. It's really an honor.
All right. I look forward to having you back on in the future, and whether it's for a tip or another adventure you go on.
Thank you so much. I look forward to that.
Thanks for listening. If you haven't done so yet, go to our website, papabearhikes.com. Listen to past episodes. Check us out on social media. Go to our YouTube channel, Martin Outside. All those links are there. In addition to that, you can buy our book or see what you're missing out on if you're not a Patreon member yet. Remember to get outside, have fun, and be safe. This episode of Papa Bear Hikes has been brought to you by Avalon Publicity. Avalon Publicity, increasing the digital footprint of content creators and skilled professionals via website development and social media services. For more information about Avalon Publicity, go to their website, avalonbusiness.org. That's avalonbusiness.org.